So the title of the talk is Awakening Will Shine Out If We Don't Cover It Up. If we don't cover it. And in the talk, I will touch non-dual space. And if it feels just a bit abstract or you don't understand, it doesn't matter. You just pick up what you can pick up and what feels right, and that's it. Don't work too hard. We're talking here about no effort, okay? So no effort to try and understand. Just what touches, what lands in us is good enough. So we have a basic kind of existential basic issue that has been troubling all human beings since the beginning of time, which is that the world seems so real that we see and we experience. It seems 100% real. Our body is our body, and then it goes. And we think, how can it go? My body, life took it away from me, and it's putting me under the earth. We don't question the reality, the assumption 100%, which we can't challenge. Who says it's my body? Who says it is a body? What the hell is this thing? Do we really know what this thing is called, a body, and own it? Like kind of chefetz? But we can't help. The same with everything. I am like this, my thoughts, my country, my... It just goes on and on and on. My objects, my possessions, my house, my family, my, and my life. And we think we own it. And then we have a big problem, which is that it seems totally imperfect, lo mushlam. So we've defined reality, we've decided what it is, and then it hits us in the face, makaba panim. It doesn't work. It's not happy. There are wars going on. And it's very confusing. How can life be like that? Did God make a mistake making life, giving us so much trouble? Where did that come from? Happily, we all have another voice in us. It's the voice that brought you all here. Brought us all here, me too. We do have another voice, a hint, a whisper of a longing, kumeha, for something else that isn't in the illusion of the belief that this is it, this is the reality, and I have to just struggle. We do have a longing that there's something else. We know somewhere deep down that peace does exist. Deep happiness does exist. We don't know where maybe to find it. We know deep down we are made of the universe. We're not made of Stephen's stuff. This stuff is... carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, made from sand, chol. We're made from spirit. The Buddha said, "Why? Who do you think you are? All you are is a bunch of daisa walking about." That's one of the texts. You're just a bunch of porridge in the English translation. You're just an that's all you are. And what? Who do you think you make such a big fuss? And all you are is all the food you ate and walking about. So we learnt in our learning, which includes Bet Sefer and Bayit and human society, and we learnt to withdraw and become contracted, you know, hitkavtzut. We contracted ourselves. We learned to be controlled by conditions that happen to us. We learned, and it's engraved in our brain. The brain has reshetot networks that say, this is this, this is that, this is that, this is that, and then we believe it. But who made the brain like that? And where did these networks come? And if my dog has another load of networks in her brain that says something different, I see a bowl like this, and it's a bowl for gong, and my dog sees it just would see the same thing as, where's the food inside? The networks in the brain of the dog are working differently. We will see a beautiful tree, and the dog will say, ah, it's just the right place to do pee-pee. Everyone has a different reality, but we all believe it to be true, and that's the problem. And the problem is, we resist infinity as much as we can. It is scary to feel that we are made of the universe, that we are kind of dust of the stars. Wow, that's so scary. How on earth can I survive? How can I get up in the morning? How can I get my, how can I pay my rent if I'm made of the dust of the stars? We just resist it. Okay, go to the doctor. I need pills. If the doctor says, why do you need a pill? You're made of stars. So we're really, in some way, we resist the big picture. And we resist it because we have the engine of survival that runs our life. Hisardut. Hitmodudut. And because of that, we believe things to be like they are in order to cope. And we believe in that we've come out of the world and we are separate units. And then we look at the world again from that place of separation with a little bit of longing. I want to come back. Even love, even we want to come back, but we don't know how. So we look at it from a distance, everything. Krishnamurti had a beautiful phrase. He said, the entire tragedy of human existence lies between the subject and the object. It's really amazing. Bein subjekt ve objekt. So everything is dualistic, subjekt, object. Because we made it like that. We've separated ourselves. We stepped out from this total belonging. And it's not our fault. It just happened to us like that. It's part of life. And in a way, it's an important message in these days, because a lot of suffering comes from the sense that we failed, we didn't do things right, it's my fault that there's killing going on and violence I'm somehow, because I'm Israeli or because I'm this or because I'm that. But we have to understand that violence has been there from the beginning of time. And not only humans. And we suffer, but the big picture is that that's the nature of the limits that we have as human beings. As human beings, we can't do that much better. So there'll be a war and then there's peace, and there'll be another war and then there's peace, and there's another war and then there's peace. We find out that these are the limits. And it's uncomfortable to know it, but it's not entirely our fault. In the Bhagavad Gita, I think it really expresses it very beautifully. Arjuna said, I can't understand. Here I am I have to fight my family. And Krishna, the God, said, nothing to do. Nature of karma. It just happened like that. You're not God. You didn't do this. So it's worth just remembering we take on ourselves, on our shoulders, a lot of suffering of the world. But a little bit we can say, okay, I will try and do what I can to help the suffering of the world, but I don't have to take it all on my shoulders. And samsara, the big picture, karma, does help with this. And a little bit helping us not to take things so personally, the tragedies around. It helps us. We feel the pain, of course, because we're open. We feel the pain, sure. We can cry, sure. But we don't have to take it on ourselves and feel smashed. And so avidya, ignorance, is what is this sense of contraction, this subject object, this limited possibilities that we find ourselves struggling with. Avidya, ignorance. And as I say, if it's not personal, then ignorance too has been there from the beginning of time. And that's very much traditional in the Buddhist world. Nirvana has been there from the beginning of time. Samsara has been there from the beginning of time. It's not just ours to here in Israel today. Frank Zappa, one of my favorite musicians of the 60s, said, stupidity is one of the elements of the universe. So but what we can have is a sense of motivation. We want to wake up from this dream. We can feel the motivation. And that's important. And let this retreat, at the minimum, restore motivation to know deeper truth of things. What is more authentic? What is wise? And to challenge what appears to be true, what everyone says is true, to challenge the apparent reality. The Buddha said a beautiful thing. Don't get enchanted means swept away, nischefet, nischefim, by the product of consciousness. Go to the source. The product is all that learning, the networks in the brain. Product, this is this, this is me, this is I am like that, etc., what I said before. That they're products, they're totsa'ot. But what's the source? The Buddha said, look at the source of things. Don't get totally caught in the products of your mind. We can really practice it here. What's our body as an experience? What is really our body as an experience? Does it really belong to us? It's a halakha, it's an assumption. But look at it, check it out. Does it really belong to us? On Tuesday, 2 or 3 days ago, I went to get my hair cut. And she swept all the hair into a pile. And I was thinking, I don't cry. That's me. You're putting in the rubbish bin, the pachashba. You're putting me in the pachashba. Why don't I cry? If we look carefully at the body, it's good enough. The body is good enough as a way of looking at a more deep truth of things. And when we look carefully at just the body, we see it doesn't necessarily belong to us. Check out, where is that voice that says mine? Where is it? What is it? And where is it that says, for example, we define the body as choma? But what does that mean? Do I know what is choma? Matter? We say this is material. What knows this? Consciousness. So consciousness decides this is mine, this is the material, this is made of this, this is where what hurts. Consciousness. And if we look carefully, we keep seeing consciousness. We don't see matter. We see, for example, that the body is made of vibrations, energies flowing. It's interesting that in Sanskrit, the same word, matter, is matter, choma, and mother. Exactly the same word. So do we know what is this body? Check it out. Check it out. And if it's, we see it as vibration, so does it stop here, the vibration? Or is it the same vibration as everything else? So, in our meditation, we keep meeting awareness, modaut. We keep meeting awareness. We see an object, a breath, our legs, a pain. But if we look carefully, it's the looking that knows this. And if we look more carefully, we're not sure what it is actually. So the practice keeps throwing us back to awareness. And then we can know, on top of the awareness, is our beliefs, descriptions, havchanot, descriptions, perceptions, learning, the neural networks are working. This is green, this is red, this is this. We can see that happening. But underneath that, there's just awareness. And in our meditations here in this few days, we can just catch that. What's actually happening? Knowing. Yidiyah. Awareness is happening. And then it goes to description. Parshanut. And we can watch that process. But somewhere underneath, awareness itself is very pure. And all the non-dual teachers and teachings go to that place in the end. In the end, awareness is like the white page. And we don't see writing if there isn't a white page that allows it. So we don't see a body if there isn't a consciousness behind it. We don't see a hand if there isn't a consciousness that allows it. But the consciousness is not the hand. The consciousness is just very pure, very open, knowing hand. Along comes the memory that says hand and my hand. But the consciousness is behind that. It's very open and free. It's like the screen, if you watch a film. The screen isn't the film. Hamasach. But without a screen, you won't see a film. One time someone asked the Buddha, no, the Buddha asked someone else, light comes in through the window. What happens if there's no wall, if it doesn't touch anything? And the student said, well, it will land on something else. Instead of the wall, it will land on a tree outside, or the light will... And if there's no tree, it will touch something, it'll go to the earth. And if there's no earth, if there's nothing, where will the light go? And the student was stuck. It's a text. The student didn't know what to say. And the Buddha said, if consciousness doesn't land on something, it's released. It's free. It's just consciousness, awareness. So I won't go into, this is a kind of a whole world of a non-dual awareness practice, and especially the Tibetans took it very deeply. And we can get a sense of it, well, I'll talk about it in a minute, but it's an image from the Tibetan practice is that our awareness is not blank. If we look at our mind, we see thought. But the awareness made the thought. Where did the thought come from? It come from the moon? It comes from our awareness. Our consciousness made a thought. The consciousness is open. And it makes things. We see things. So in the Tibetan tradition, it's the mother and thought is the children. Consciousness is like a mother or like a womb, rachem, full of potential, and it keeps making children, called thought, called things. So it's just a nice image that you can sort of play with. So basically in the Buddhist tradition, I could say there's two great highways. And the first is the one that perhaps we've known in previous retreats. It's about vipassana, seeing clearly. And we challenge the truth of the forms and the beliefs, and the sense of being stuck. We challenge it by awareness, by looking at it. What is it that, and the Buddha was teaching it right from the beginning, why are we stuck? Why are we separate? Why do we define the world as a problem and live in it like that? What are the obstacles? And a lot of the Buddhist, really, I suppose, most of the early Buddhist practice is about that. And it's seeing the key is unsatisfaction, is something missing. So dukkha, anything that makes us uncomfortable here, is a key. It's a teacher for us. And that's very fundamental in the Buddhist path. When we see discomfort, something missing, something hurting, something difficult, something problematic, something imprisoning us, we feel not free, go there. That's a teacher. Labels, mental patterns, tavniot, mentaliot, beliefs. And that this kind of direction is undoing our sense of attachment to forms, beliefs, mental structures, descriptions, definitions, history, identity, all of that. Our belief in that is questioning it all through direct knowing. And that's the Vipassana tradition. It's what you all know from retreats. In some way, we're still doing it here. And this, in this tradition, nirvana, meaning awakening, is not really leading us. It's the we're undoing the obstacles, and nirvana appears by itself. So a great deal of this tradition has negative language, breaking the conditioning. The first words of the Buddha when he awakened were, for lifetimes after lifetimes, I've believed in this house, and I was inside it, and now I've seen it's just a house, and I can break the structure. And I broke the structure of this house, and now I'm in a place called the unborn, no birth, meaning ultimacy, hamuchlat. So it's very typical language of the of the Dharma, which is in a way a negative language, undoing the blocks, the covers, the restrictions, undoing the illusions, and then nirvana shines by itself. Anicca is an example of a deeper truth that does this. We see that everything passes, and so we try not. We see we believe in things, but we see they disappear. And everything we believe in, and everything we need, and everything we rely on, and everything that we think is ours, it all goes. So there's a deep lessening, a deep truth in that. We can't even catch a thought. A thought that gives us so much trouble, that goes round and round and round and round in our minds. Got a project, you got a project tomorrow. Try and catch it. Try and look at it directly. Oh, I've got this terrible day, these terrible thoughts coming, and I'm fears and this. Try and catch the thought. Who are you? It's uncatchable. It comes and goes. It's anatta, one of the other of the sort of three jewels or three Jews. duality, self and the world, me and the world. But is it really like that? What is me and what is world? And if we take out the me from the duality, then there's only universe left. So it's very direct. And it actually, most of the Advaita teachers, like Ramana Maharshi, and as well as the Buddha, they work deeply on this sense of, if you look directly at the self, it vanishes, it dissolves, because it's not a thing, it's a habit. Very deep, but it's a habit. So the Advaita teachers go and look at this, find the self, try and catch it, and you can't catch it. Where is it? This finger, this finger, this finger. Where's the self? This finger, the hair that the hairdresser put in the rubbish bin. So So the second track is more the non-dual track that we're touching on in this retreat. And there, it's rather different. There, from the beginning, we are interested in awakening. And it is also hugely developed from the very early days of the Buddhist teaching. But then it became very, very strong in different movements, Zen and the non-dual Tibetan teachings. So right at the very beginning of the teaching, there is the Eightfold Path, which is the classic path. The Fourth Noble Truth is the Eightfold Path. And it starts with right view. And right view, that you all may know about, is the first of the Eightfold Path. It's already non-dual. And I have one or two quotes here. The Buddha said, generally, this world is seen as a polarity, duality, existence or non-existence. It appears or it disappears. It is there or it's not there. But when one sees the origin of the world as it actually is, non-existence doesn't occur to you. There is just existence. And when you see ending of something, that's what you see. So you don't see, you don't need a duality. When something finishes, it's gone. When something arises, it appears. There's no duality, separation. Something arises, that's what happens. Something disappears, that's what happens. Everything exists is one extreme. Everything doesn't exist is another extreme. Avoiding these two extremes, I, the Tathagata, the Buddha is talking about, teaches the Dharma in the middle. It's not that one or it's not the other. There's no duality there. And a very beautiful phrase from also from the Buddha is, our awareness is shining and infinite, and experiences arrive as visitors. It's exactly the white page that allows writing to be seen, or the screen. Our awareness is shining because it's alive and infinite, and experiences appear as visitors. There is an invitation to go directly to that place. It's a invitation to connect directly with the space of awareness that knows. So it's just the space of knowing, without filters, without networks in the brain, without history, without conditioning, without breaking what the Buddha said, break the house. Dharma Dhatu. Space of Dharma, it's space. It's like the space in the room. We're not interested in the space of the room, but the space of the room is the awareness that's behind everything. We don't see each other here in this room without the space that allows it. We can't see each other without light that allows it. And no one's interested in the light. Where is it? Can you find the light in this room? We only know it because it shines on people. And then we say, oh, there's consciousness or awakening is in that place. It's invisible when we only see objects. But it allows us to see objects. Without that, without the awareness, we cannot see any object. We cannot know anything. So going to that place is a very interesting place. And I'll say a few words about how to do that. And we've actually been saying it already. And I want to add a few more thoughts about it. But it's a place that isn't in the descriptions of the world. Someone asked the Buddha, how do you recognize an awakened person? And the Buddha answered, you recognize them because you can't find them. And the person asking said, what? I don't understand. That's just such a puzzle. You mean they don't exist or they do exist? And the Buddha said, yeah, they exist like you. They live. But they're indescribable. You cannot pin them down. You can't give them. No labels work. No language works. No descriptions work anymore. No objects work. In the brain that we're used to, the ways that we label things and we believe them don't work anymore. So the person is gone from any language and description that we are used to. And awakening is in that place. It isn't in the place of description. You can never say a person is awakened. Some people do. Some people say, I. Krishnamurti is really very aggressive. He said, this is disgusting for a person to say, I'm awakened. But it's one, we can keep doing this by trying to look at things and not really finding them. And it's really important that we look and think at things and don't try and find them, and we can't find them. We think we failed. Oh, it doesn't work for me. I should have Zikukei Dinur. I went to a retreat and I didn't get ecstasy and I didn't see you don't need to. Imaho says this book called The Flight of the Garuda, that's one of the Tibetan texts that I really love, and I read it again and again. A Garuda, again, that bird that appears from the egg, fully awakened, fully flying ready. If you look carefully at your mind, and when you fail to find a mind that you could point to and say, this is it, and when you fail to find even anything that you could call mutsak, concrete, then your failure is a total success. And he gives many, many methods. I won't go into it. It's a beautiful book, and it's just full of so many kind of beautiful ways of doing this. He says, when what we call mind is constantly chattering and hopping and skipping and jumping about, try to catch it and it slips away. It changes its shape. It vanishes. Attempt to focus on your mind and it will not be still. Try to put a label on it and it just disappears into nothing. But it's the same mind through which we experience all human feelings. What is the origin of it? Is it the wind? Where is it now? I'm asking you right now, like he says, where is your mind right now? Is it in your body? Where in your body is your mind? What's its color, shape? When it moves, where does it go? Etc. Many, many directions. I won't go into it more. There's something also in this retreat that is a real nechama, relief. That you could say one thing that is special about this retreat. We only have one retreat like this in a year, right? Okay, two, great. So you have another one in the summer. But it gives you permission, in a way, not to have to struggle with tochen. It's really kind of relief. I don't need to struggle with tochen, with content, with issues. I don't need to solve anything. I don't need to keep working to try and clean all the stuff in the mind that is upsetting me and so on. I can, what's the sky behind the clouds? The sky that's undisturbed by all the clouds, by the Yerutim, like my image yesterday. What's the sky that's not disturbed? It is part of us too. Not part of us, but it is our source. It's a source. We stay with the sources anyway. We stay under the experiences. It's not so difficult. We're looking at our breathing. Just know, knowing the breath is happening. What is happening is knowing. The object of knowing is the breath. But we can go back and just say, it is known. It's very simple. The body, it is known. A thought, it is known. I think it's important to challenge the known, the details, to challenge the descriptions. Just rest in a sense of knowing, but don't need to define it and say, this is it, this is this, this is a, just like we enjoy the smell of a flower. We don't need to say what's the botany and what's the name of it and who planted it. And we don't need to just receive. In some way or other, we need to keep falling off the edge of things. We need to we go to the thoughts and we go beyond, we fall off. We go to the end of thinking, fall off. The nigudim in life, the paradoxes, are invitations for us to go to that place. Not to solve them, and they're many, they're all the time we face them. Shall I do this or shall I do that? How is it like that? How is this possible? That's one against the other. I'm so confused. Stay there. Don't solve it. Allow it to work in us. Questions. The Buddha said, whatever you think things are, they are always other than that. Whatever you think things to be, they're always other than that. So one thing that we're doing here is exploring to be the witness, a edut, to witness a breath, a body, a thought. We are more interested in the witnessing than we are in the objects. So right now, There's a field of knowing we're all aware. We're aware we exist. We know we're sitting here. We know we're listening. There's a knowing, a field of knowing. And you can just kind of celebrate that. Go there. Drop into it. Just, it's all you need. So witnessing, edut. You see, it's clear when we look at thought. Because thought, in order to see a thought, we step back a bit. So there's thinking going on. Not so difficult. Sometimes I've given talks to kind of hundreds of people who have never had any meditation in their life. I've done it a few times. I remember at Cinematheque. And I was asking them, okay, I'll give you 1 minute. Count the thoughts in this minute. So they all sit 1 minute silence. And then I ask a bunch of people, how many thoughts? And they all have numbers. 5, 7, 8. Meaning they know that there's thoughts. It's not so difficult. In other words, you only know you're thinking if you are witness to thought. And what we're doing here is quite easy. We just step back and say, okay, there's thinking going on. But in the witness has two aspects. One is a point of view, nukudamabat. I step back and I see thought. But the other aspect of witnessing is pure consciousness. It's just knowing. If you ask, really, who is it that knows thought? What is it that knows thought? Not so easy. It's just consciousness that knows thought. It's again the white page. So it's really helpful to keep questioning, to keep opening, to keep witnessing things and not to believe anything. One of the classic traditional images is that all reality that you see is like the moon on water. You know it's a moon, but you can't catch it. It's the moon is shining on the water. It's something there, but you can't catch it. It's not it. Someone once told me of a story from Chelm, where they had no light left in the village. And someone had a bright idea. Let's capture the moon. Let's capture the moon. And if we can hold on to the moon, then we have light for the village. So they opened a barrel of water, and the moon was shining on the water, and they quickly put a lid on it to try and... As we practice here, there's something, what's important is presence. We're continuing to be present, to be aware. That's all we need to do. And continually give awareness, presence, more importance than what we actually see, which constantly changes. But what's the thread that doesn't change? Our experience in one day, million experiences we're having in one day. But what allows it all and what doesn't change is like the kazer chut and then kol ha-charuzim. All our experiences are on the thread. What is the thread? It's that. Something stays. So in our practice, we are in some way with both the two tracks I talked about, the track of purification, tihur, working with content, vipassana, working, seeing things, undoing them, knowing anicca, changeability, transience, arayut, knowing non-self, you know, the classic track. And the more non-dual track, and they work together all the time. we're actually doing both. And in our life, we do both. So we don't deny our humanness. We don't try and go into idealism. Never mind what I'm saying from the bummer. We don't need idealism. We don't need to, because they try and run after rainbows. It happens a lot in the non-dual world, in the, especially Advaita, great Advaita teachers that would say amazing, amazing things. And people get totally intoxicated and feel, and it's really beautiful sometimes, but then they go home and it's all gone. Where was that? I had a great time in India, but why do I fight everybody still? Why am I still the same person? It's because of an idealization. It's because we put it up there somewhere. So we don't deny our humanness. In this last period, I've been working quite a bit with others on grief and mourning, Hitaplut. And because we had in Klil, and if you know, but we had a big tragedy that Mashiv Nefesh burnt, and 3-4 weeks ago, and my oldest friend in Israel, burnt with the building in one night. And so I lost personally my oldest friend, my best friend, that 20 years I was sitting with him every Shabbat. 20 years, every single Shabbat, if I wasn't here. And so, and in a way, the grief is our humanness, but it's also grief and mourning for a life that we lost totally in this country and in this planet. We need to go through mourning, not to kind of pretend that we're in, you know, the bliss of Dharma. No. We need to be human. We need to see. But everything in the human world has its base in a bigger, impersonal, universal. So even grief, when we look at grief carefully, we give it space. It opens to life again. It's not about misery at all. It's about opening a space where life appears again, and fullness of life. And same with mourning. We mourn, and we can feel loss. Many of us do. Many of us feel deep loss, personal loss, people close to us. But under the loss, there's a message, there's a deep place of letting things go, of the preciousness of life that we lost. So what is precious? There is love in that, and there is surrender. Loss helps us to surrender and not to take it personally. Loss, uvdan. Yes, but it can take us to a bigger place. And always, we look for the space behind things, around things, the ending of things. A moment of anger, atzbanut, emotion, difficulties, struggle. When it's over, what's then? That space is like the space in the room. There was something strong, especially anger, strong energy. But if we see when the anger is finished, it opens a space. We're looking here for spaces, gaps, between one thought and the next, between one moment and the next, between changes of consciousness, when we go and fall asleep. Any changes, mavarim, they point to spaces. Between one breath and the next, there's a tiny space. These are the places we actually, where there's no content, the place of mystery. And be interested in space, in things that are not defined. that don't have labels, that don't have definitions, that don't have memory, that don't have structure, that don't have descriptions. And the big picture always helps us as we trust it more, that there's a bigger story behind it all. Can just trust it more, it will help us. We might not be able to define it or describe it. It's more like the invisible. It becomes slowly, slowly, as we develop, it becomes our point of reference, Nukudamabat. The universal becomes our point. Life itself becomes our point of reference, Nukudamabat, instead of me. Life itself looks out of our eyes instead of me. And that everything looks different. And then we find, final sentence, that it's all remembering. We never left it. The life was always looking out of our eyes, but we didn't give it space. Instead, we pushed away the life, and then we had me looking out of our eyes and at things. But when everything opens and becomes more universal, we realize we were always there, but we forgot. So it's about remembering. And so we come back to the world and it welcomes us. We come back to the universe, it welcomes us. I missed you. You were stuck in individuality. Come back. I'm ready for you. It's beautiful what my old friend that died. He died as he lived. But he was saying before he died, and his last years of his life were so happy. He was really in a very special place, I would say. And he was saying, this body, time for it to go back. I'm ready. It can go back to where it came from. That's fine. So we rejoin the world and it opens us back, opens its arms to us and welcomes us back. We don't have to give our body. We give our mind good enough. Thank you. So we'll just take a moment of quiet.